Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're going to start our study of 2 Samuel tonight in chapters 1 and 2, which is basically the background to the birth of Samuel and the beginning of the problems of Eli and his family. And then in chapter 2 is going to be a psalm of praise by Hannah. So I hope you'll get your Bibles and follow with me. Now, there was a certain man from Ramathim Zophim. And, of course, this is a basic plural form of Ramah, which means height. Many think it means the twin heights. There's several places in the Promised Land called the Ramah, or the height. This is a particular one, Zophim. Some think this is from a particular ancestor of Elkanah. And I'm not sure about that. It seems to be a possibility from Suf, and it may be just a clan name, like it said. Now, Ramah is the place where Samuel's hometown is going to be. His ministry is going to be focused from there. He's going to be buried there. You see that from 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 17, 15:34, 16:13, 19:28 through 23, and 25:1, Ramah. It says, the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoham, and several lists of the ancestors here. Now, we learn from 1 Chronicles chapter 6, verses 22 through 28, and verses 33 through 38, that he apparently is a Levite. Well, how can it say here that he is an Ephraimite? Well, apparently, the Levitical cities, 48 of them, we learn from Joshua, were spread out throughout the tribal allocations, and the Levites that lived in those tribal allocations apparently sometimes took on the name of that tribe, though they were still Levites, and that seems to be the idea here. And he had two wives. This was not the norm. Apparently, he was a wealthy man. Maybe it was because Hannah was barren and he wanted children that he took the second wife. That's usually the main reason. And here he has two wives, one named Hannah, which means graceful, and the other was Peninnah, and which means a red pearl, sometimes translated red coral. Had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, this is a pattern we've seen before. Here is someone who's barren, and they're going to be the one God chooses to show that he's in charge of his world. You might want to see, well, it's just several times in here. It's been true of Sarah, it was true of Rebecca, and on, now it's true of Hannah. Notice it says, now the man went up from his city yearly. Now, back in Leviticus 23, and also in Exodus 23, it talks about three yearly feasts. How come this yearly? Well, we learn from Judges 19:21 that there was a yearly feast at Shiloh, and apparently this man was doing the best he understood, and he was going up once a year, which shows his devotion to the Lord, to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts. Now, this is Lord Sabbath, and it has four possible meanings. Some of the ones means it means it's the captain of the army of heaven, a military term. Matter of fact, some translations translate this the God of battles, or the God of forces, or the Lord of legions. And you might want to see 1 Samuel 17:45 for something to back that up. Second one, it can be used for the host of heaven, meaning the heavenly bodies, the stars, the planets that were sometimes seen to be gods or angels or Elohim. You might want to see Judges 5:20 and Isaiah 40:26. Now, sometimes it's used in the sense of the host of heaven, the angelic host, the God as the leader of the angelic council. And you might want to see Joshua chapter 5, verses 14 and 15. It's often used in a special background to show that God was with his people Israel. And I think that's the idea here. It means he is with the multitude of Israel, the legion of Israel. And those are the different possibilities. Notice it's at Shiloh. We learn from Joshua 18:1, Joshua 18:31, and Joshua 19:21 that Joshua put the Ark of the Covenant, the tabernacle, at Shiloh and moved it from Gilgal to Shiloh. And this became the central shrine during the period of Joshua and Judges. And apparently 1 Samuel is this part of 1 Samuel. The background is the early part of Judges. And he had the two sons of Eli were Hophni and Phinehas. Now, these are Egyptian names, which might go back to the time that the children of Israel were back in Egypt. We're not exactly sure. Maybe it's a way of showing that their tendency to get away from the Lord by their names. I'm not sure. Were priests to the Lord there. Apparently, this man, like the priesthood was supposed to do, was going to pass through families. Many say these first two chapters is not only the birth of Samuel, the last judge, but also showing that the priesthood is going to pass from Eli's family into Zadok's family during the reign of David. And that may be another reason why this background is given like this. And when the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. Apparently she was very fruitful and had a lot of children. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion. Now, the etymology of the word double is somewhat in dispute, but it does show that he loved her in a special way. You might want to see verse 6. And then later on, he says, to who art I better to you than 10 sons in verse 8. And apparently he gave her an extra amount or a special amount or a double amount. Anyway, it's going to cause jealousy that's going to come out so much in verse 6 that the other wife is going to really pick on Hannah. It's kind of the same thing that happened with the wives of Abraham early. But the Lord had closed her womb. That's something that God has done. You might want to see Genesis 16:1, Genesis 30:1-2. Apparently God was using this in a special way. He was going to work things out, show his power, and this is the way he chose to do it. So year after year, the man would come up to, notice it says, the house of the Lord in verse 7. And then in verse 9, it says, the temple of the Lord. And it says that Eli was sitting by the doorpost. Now, this doesn't sound like a description of the tabernacle, which was a tent. Now, there are two possibilities here. We're talking about the tabernacle, which was a tent, but we're using building terms to describe it. Now, in Psalm 78:60, it still refers to the tent at Shiloh. But others believe it was a more substantial structure, though not a palace, not a permanent structure, but a more substantial wooden frame kind of thing to some extent. And that may be true because this term is usually used for Solomon's temple. And matter of fact, in chapter 3, verse 15, we even see that the temple had doors and the tabernacle, of course, had veils. So I think there was some kind of structure, though what it is, we're not sure. And the other wife began to provoke her at this meal. It was a sacrificial meal. They would give part of the animal to be sacrificed on the altar. The blood poured out. The priest would get a part. Then Elkanah would get it back to eat with his family, a communal meal, kind of like the peace offering or fellowship offering of Leviticus. And he says to her in verse 8, am I not better to you than 10 sons? Now, this is an idiom in Hebrew for meaning, I love you so much, I'm good to you, I'm kind to you, why are you crying? But she wanted to be a mother. That's why she's crying. And Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now, this seems to show that it was a sacrificial meal. Now, Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat by the doorpost. We found these seats in very wealthy men's houses where they would sit over in the courtyard and kind of give their advice to the family. Eli's going to fall off this seat. Apparently, it had no back. He was leaning up against the doorpost. It's been common in archaeology, and that may be what it is, though we can't be dogmatic. She was greatly distressed and prayed to the Lord, wept bitterly. She made a vow. Now, for this vow, you might want to see Leviticus 27, where a husband had to confirm his wife's vow, and also Numbers 30, verses 6 through 15. Because down here in verse 21, it says that Elkanah paid his vow. We're not sure what that vow can refer to unless he affirmed his wife's vow, or maybe it's referring something to the sacrifices he just gave, but we can't be sure. O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy maidservant, which is the barrenness she's talking about, and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son. Now, literally, it's the seed of men. It means a male child. Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come upon his head. Now, this is an implication of the Nazarite vow that is going to be spelled out in the early verses of Numbers chapter 6. The Septuagint has an expanded form here about no wine. The Septuagint, in many places in Samuel, because the Hebrew text is somewhat in disarray, helps us understand that the Septuagint is longer, but we have found a Hebrew ancestor in the cave number 4 at Qumran that seems to follow the Septuagint manuscript instead of the Masoretic manuscript, which shows that the ancestors to the Septuagint were also ancient Hebrew manuscripts. I'll point several places out to you in this study what the Septuagint says. Here it adds the idea of wine, which is another part that the Nazarites have to totally stay away from. Then in verse 12, that came about as she continued praying for the Lord, that and Elkanah was watching her mouth. Now, this seems to be unusual. He's going to accuse her of being drunk. Now, this says two things to me. Number one, possibly silent prayers were not very normal in that day. And number two, that drunkenness apparently was normal, even at the temple during some of these sacrificial meals with families. And so he had seen it enough to know, and maybe he was shocked by the silent prayer. We're just not sure. He accuses her of being drunk, but she says, oh, that's just not true. And in verse 15, she tries to describe what's happening. No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink. Now, strong drink is different kinds of additives to wine to make the alcohol content more. But I have poured out my soul before the Lord. The word here for soul is the word nephesh. Many have said this is a good passage where the idea of the blood poured out the altar, the Hebrews thought the life was in the blood, but here the nephesh is connected with the blood. As the breath, which is the spirit here, goes out of the body dies. As the blood was poured out, the body dies. And some say we're connecting the nephesh and the blood here because the word poured out. But I'm not sure we can do that. That's pushing it a little hard here. Do not consider your maidservant to be a worthless woman. Now, this is the word Belial. It's used in the Jewish apocryphal literature as a title for Satan. But in the Old Testament, it just seems to me a worthless fellow, someone who is no good. And she's saying, I'm not that. And so it's obvious here that drunkenness among women was condemned, and this is an idea we can see that. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him. Now, the word ask here is going to be a play on this word several times through here, because the word ask is going to be the root of Samuel's name. And she said, let your maidservant find favor. Now, the word Hannah and the word favor is a play on the Hebrew here. In your sight. So the woman went away and ate, and her face was no longer sad. The fact that she went back and ate shows that she believed that God was going to answer her request. She believed the priest had the ability to bless. This is one of the few examples in the Bible of a priest blessing an individual worshiper. But apparently she believed what God was going to do for her, and she went back confident that he would work it out some way. Now, when it says in verse 18, the Septuagint adds this, and she entered the dining hall. Many of us believe it's quite possible that next to the central sanctuary was a special room for these fellowship meals, and that is seemed to implied here in the Septuagint, which may be a better text, at least in 1 Samuel. Now, then they rose early in the morning, worshipped before the Lord, and returned again to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah had relations with his wife. This is the word he knew his wife, Genesis 4:1. The word know becomes a metaphor of intimate knowledge. And so when it says that Phinehas and Hophni knew not the Lord, it doesn't mean they didn't know about the Lord, didn't know some of the rules, didn't know his names. They didn't have an intimate relationship with him, and that's going to be settled right here. It talks about he knew his wife, and of course, the Lord remembered her. This same thing is mentioned in Exodus chapter 2, verse 24. Usually you want the Lord to forget because it's the ideal of sins, but to remember your request, remember your need is the metaphor here to describe how the Lord cared about her. And as she conceived and gave birth to a son and named him Samuel. And here's the popular etymology. Because I have asked him of the Lord. Now, really, this is closer to the name Saul. But there's a play on the word here. Literally, Samuel means his name is El. Now, this could mean that Samuel called on the name of the Lord. Or the idea could be here that Hannah called on the name of the Lord. Now, I'm not exactly sure which it is. It's kind of a play on the word named, where Saul is a play on the word ask. Now, notice if you would in verse 21 where it says, and the man Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord yearly sacrifice and pay his vow. I think it's related to Hannah's vow about the boy. Because the next verse says, but Hannah was not want to go up. Why? Because she promised the Lord when she went, she would give this boy away. Apparently she wanted to keep him and wean him. Now we know from the ancient world that the nursing was thought to be a way of birth control for some people. And we know that even nursed children 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years. Matter of fact, from 2 Maccabees chapter 7, verse 27, we have a 3-year weaning example. So I think Samuel was several years old when Hannah brought him initially. This meant that she had the time to train him at home and teach him about the Lord in these early formative years. And Elkanah says, you do whatever you want to, and when he's old enough, you bring him. Now, when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, a 3-year-old bull. Now, this 3-year-old bull comes from the Septuagint. The Masoretic text has 3 bulls, but that doesn't fit. It's the age that made it sacrificially acceptable. And here we have other things about flour and a jug of wine, and several things were involved in the sacrifice, so the priest would have more than just meat to eat. And the Septuagint adds a little phrase here at the very end of verse 24. Now, mine says, although the child was young. But the literal Masoretic Hebrew text says, although the boy was a boy. Well, that doesn't make much sense. Here's the addition in the Septuagint, and it's also been found in cave number 4 of the Qumran scrolls. And the boy was with them, and they brought him before the Lord, and his father killed the sacrifices as he did year by year before the Lord, and she brought the boy. Now that seems to make much more sense, and I think the Septuagint there probably has a better reading. Now verse 25, they slaughtered the bull. Notice that the man participated in the killing of the animal, and the priest just caught the blood. The sacrifice was a pretty gory thing, and the man who brought it had to skin it and kill it and many other things that we're surprised about. And notice it says, and she said, "Oh my Lord, as your soul lives." Now this is a play on the name for Yahweh, which is from the Hebrew verb to be. As your soul lives, as the Lord lives. This is a play on that, an oath. I am a woman who stood before you praying to the Lord. And this shows that standing while you sacrifice and praying was the common thing of that day, not kneeling. This is the boy I pray, and the Lord has given me my petition. I ask, there's that play, of him. So I dedicate him to the Lord as long as he lives. Now, Nazarite vows were limited. This was a permanent. He is dedicated to the Lord. Now, all these are a play on the word ask. Petition, ask, dedicate are all forms of the word ask, which kind of a play on Samuel's name. Now, in chapter 2, I want you to notice this is the praise of Hannah. There is some problems in this because it mentions a king, and there's not a king yet. And some wonder if Hannah wrote all this or if it's a later insertion by a later hand in Hannah's name. I simply don't know. I think it can be explained to be old as Hannah's time, but I'm not sure of that. I don't want to completely disregard all critical scholarship. Some of it helps us. Most of it, I think, is destructive, but it could be this was one far away put back in Hannah's mouth. Then Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord." Now, the word horn usually is used for power and might. But there is one place in 1 Chronicles chapter 25:5 where it refers to having children, and that might be the reference here because that fits the context so much better. "My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies." Now, literally, this means is stretched. It seems to be a metaphor of boldness. Who her enemies were, it may be the other wife who was causing her so much trouble. I just don't know. "Because I rejoice in thy salvation." Of course, salvation in the Old Testament means physical deliverance, not spiritual salvation. The salvation was in a child, and now she couldn't be kidded. "There is no one like thee, O Lord. Indeed, there is no one beside thee." Now, this is repeated in 2 Samuel 22:32. I believe it speaks about monotheism. It kind of is the same category as Exodus chapter 20, verse 3, where it says, "There is no other God before thee," which means beside thee, in front of thee, behind thee. You're a category all to yourself. And that's what Hannah is saying here. You're a God that acts, in contradistinction from the idols that cannot act. "Nor is there any rock like our God." The word rock is the word of stability, a fortress, a protection. You might want to see Deuteronomy 32, 4 and 15 and 30. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 4, 15, and 30. And the beautiful introduction to Psalms 18:2, where the word rock is used for God. Kind of like a high and mighty fortress, a stable, unchanging person. Ooh, it's wonderful. "Boast no more so very proudly, and do not let the arrogant come out of your mouth." Now, this seems to refer maybe to the other wife, Peninnah. We're just not sure. "For the Lord is great of knowledge," and this is an intensive plural, full of knowledge, "and with him actions are weighed." It means things are balanced out in life. Now, what follows is the reversal of roles. There's a reversal between Hannah and Peninnah. There's also a reversal that God does between the rich and the poor, the arrogant and the humble. And that's what's kind of spoken of through here. And notice somebody being barren is mentioned specifically in the end of verse 5, and it says she has 7 children. Well, we learn from chapter 2, verse 21, she really only has 6, including Samuel. But 7 was the perfect number, and she felt like she had the perfect number of children. It's not meant to be taken literally anyway. And she who has many children languishes. And of course, I think it's a reference back to women who have more kids but don't trust the Lord. "The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and he raises up." You might want to see chapter 32, verse 39 for kind of another parallel for this. Many have wondered if this is talking about an afterlife. And it's quite possible that it is. But it also may be talking about physical health, that he brings people to the point of sickness and brings them back alive. Some say it even might refer to the idea of having birth. And if it is birth making one alive, then it refers again to this supernatural birth of Samuel. And in context, you can't tell. Now, Sheol is, of course, the realm of the dead, Hades, and it's a parallel to death, okay? Let's see. Notice that God's in control of history is the thrust of verse 8. Matter of fact, the Septuagint of verse 8 even adds this little phrase, granting the vow to the vower. And, of course, that fits the context of Hannah's prayer and vow to God. It makes a lot of sense. God is in control of history. He's going to set things straight. He's going to reverse the roles that evil society gives to men. He keeps the feet of his godly ones in verse 9. What's the idea of that? Well, this is the classical Old Testament passage about God's going to bless those who love him, and he's going to temporarily judge those who don't. It's the idea about keeping a man's feet on a straight path, that God's Word is a light unto my path, and it's that kind of structure here. It's a very classical ancient theology from the Old Testament. Those who contend with the Lord will be scattered. Among them he will thunder in the heavens. Now the word thunder here, he, may be a Ugaritic pronoun or a word for the exalted one, and that may fit the idea better. Verse 10 really might refer to the idea that God's going to reverse the roles of Eli's house. Now Eli is an ancestor of the priest Abathar, and we learned that Abathar is going to go with one of David's sons, Adonijah, in rebellion. And when he does that, he's finally exiled by Solomon, and another priestly line, Zadok, takes over. And some say that verse 10 is a way of referring to the Eli's descendants cut off, including Abathar, and the instatement of the Zadokian priesthood in the reign of David. But I'm not sure we can go that far. Notice it says, the Lord will judge the ends of the earth, a universal judge. And the mention of king here, and the mention of his anointed, is quite unusual. There's not a king yet. It may go back to the prophecy in Deuteronomy, or it may speak of the Messiah who was seen as king, the coming one. We're just not really sure about this reference to king here. This is probably the best commentary out on 1 Samuel. It's 1 Samuel by Garden in the Bible Interpretation Series, the Library of Biblical Interpretation, put out by Regency, which is a company of Zondervan. It's probably the best one on 1 and 2 Samuel. Notice it mentions here that Elkanah went home. They left the boy with the priest. Now, verse 12. Now, the sons of Eli were worthless men. Same term, Belial, worthless. You might want to see Deuteronomy 13:13 and Judges 19:22. They did not know the Lord. They knew about the Lord. They just didn't know him in a personal way. That's the problem here. And the custom of the priests and the people. Now, what we're going to find, the custom is mentioned in Leviticus 7:29-34, about how much of the sacrifice they are to get and when they are to get it. Here it mentions they boil the meat, and they were to stick a fork in and get it. But what these boys were doing was taking the meat first, even before God had it, had the fat and the blood offered to him. It was a real sacrilege. In verse 15, the fat is mentioned. You might want to see Leviticus 3:3-5, Leviticus 7:31-34. And that'll give you an idea. Deuteronomy 18:3 is another place. Now, they also are going to They're going to say, we'll take it by force if you don't give it to us. In verse 16, they even corrupted these women. The men despised the Lord in verse 17. Now, notice the contrast with Samuel here. Samuel in 18-21 is wearing a linen ephod his mother made like a priest. He's acting much more godly than these true Levites. Some say Samuel is a Levite. That's true if we go to 1 Chronicles. But he's a godly Levite. These are ungodly priests. In verse 22, it says Eli was very old. We learn from chapter 4, verse 15, he was 98 then. He's somewhere around 90 here. He feared that his sons were doing evil in Israel. They were laying with women who served the doorway. Well, we're not sure about that women served the doorway. It sounds like a cultic, the cultic prostitutes of Canaan. Some say these women that served in menial tasks is found in Exodus 38:8 and Judges 11:31, and that may be true. Others say that this refers to kind of separation from Baal worship. You might want to see Deuteronomy 23:17. But they were sexually immoral as well as cheating with the sacrifices. Notice verse 25. It's very hard in Hebrew. You ought to look at the different English translations. Is it God will mediate for him? If he sins against God, who will mediate for him? The word God here is Elohim. There are places that Elohim can mean judge. The King James translates this as judge, not as God. And so I think the first phrase refers to a human judge, and the second phrase refers to the Lord, but I'm not sure. No one can intercede. That's the idea of praying for somebody. We know that's what Jesus still does for us from 1 John 2:1. That's what the Holy Spirit will do from John 14:16. And it's an Old Testament sense that God intercedes for his people too. Notice in verse 27 and following, we have an unnamed man of God. We're not sure who he is. God does not speak directly to Eli. He speaks directly to Samuel, but not to Eli. And here's another unnamed prophet. It seems to show that the Eli and his line are going to be cut off. We see how that happened to one of his descendants, Abathar, in 1 Kings 2:27, because he followed after Adonijah and was not faithful to David. That may be the reference here, though I'm just not sure. In verse 30, we see how this was supposed to pass on to his children, and that we see that this priestly line was meant to move through family, Exodus 29:9, Numbers 25:13, but there was a problem here, and he will be excluded. Now, the sanctuary is going to be destroyed. We feel like archaeologically We think it happened around 1050. We might want to, it's referred to in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 7:12, Jeremiah chapter 26, verses 6 and 9. Archaeology confirms the destruction here. Eli will die. We'll learn more about that in chapter 3. His sons will die. The sanctuary is destroyed. The ark is stolen. The place is burned. And that's going to be a problem. Verse 33 promises he won't kill everybody of Eli's line. There'll be someone left because Abathar is going to be in the line of Eli. And notice in verse 35, but I will raise up for myself a faithful priest. We think that refers to Zadok, 1 Kings 2:35. I will build him an enduring house. And this is very similar to 2 Samuel chapter 7, where it talks about building the dynasty of David. Here we're talking about the dynasty of a faithful priesthood. It's a play on the word house. It's not house in the sense of a building, but house in the sense of a lineage, descendants, and that's what it here. And then in verse 36, the priests that are left will be relegated to poverty. And so we see how the line of Eli is being excluded, and a new family of Levites are going to be priests. And this may be a prophecy that refers to what's going to happen with Abathar and Zadok, or it may just be to Eli's particular family, the death of his two sons, Phinehas and Hophni. These two chapters set the stage for the rest of the book, God beginning the monarchy, and God moving from a judge into the prophet. Samuel is a mediator between both of those. I have really enjoyed being with you, and we'll do chapter 3 next time. God bless you. Have a good day.